Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of the program, we will return to a subject we have discussed many times before in this program, and that is the politics of the Middle East, and very specifically, the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. We have tried on this program over the years to present many different points of view, and there certainly are different points of view. And this morning, in an attempt to do that, we will be talking with a journalist. His name is Jonathan Cook. He's British. And he is not only one of the few journalists that write about this region that is an independent, but he is also the first foreign correspondent to be based in the Israeli Arab city of Nazareth in the Galilee. As he points out, most reporters that cover this conflict, the Israel-Palestinian conflict, either live in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, and there are a few people who live in Ramallah in the West Bank. But he believes that his position, both where he lives there and also the fact that he is an independent journalist, enables him to approach this story in ways that other reporters don't. So we'll be talking about that very thing here this morning. He's spending some time in the United States traveling around talking, and this morning he is in Chicago, and he's joining us by telephone. And I do want to mention that we do try very hard on this program to act on suggestions from listeners for topics and guests, and that is why we're doing this program here this morning. And I think I could say, in all of the history of Focus 580, I can't recall a time when we've been more heavily lobbied to have a particular guest on this program, and we do try to respond to that. We're doing the show this morning. Let me tell you just a little bit more about Jonathan Cook. He has worked as a staff member for both The Guardian and Observer newspapers between 1996 and 2001. Since 2001, he's been writing as an independent, a freelancer in Nazareth. He is a graduate of London University, has a master's degree in Middle Eastern Studies. From there, he has also written for a number of other publications, including, of course, The Guardian and Observer, but also the International Herald Tribune, Al-Ahram Weekly, that's based in Cairo, The Daily Star, based in Beirut, The Middle East Report and Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, and The Irish Times, just to name a few. Questions, comments are welcome. All we ask of people is when they call in, just to try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many different callers as possible. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome. Welcome to join the conversation, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and also toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Cook, hello.
Hello there, David.
Thanks for talking with us. I wonder if you wouldn't mind talking about a current topic, I know that certainly you have written about last summer's war in Lebanon, the war that Israel waged against Hezbollah. Now in the news, there has been a report that was authored in Israel, very critical of the prime minister and of the Israeli military about how this operation was carried out. It seems that the prime minister, Ehud Olmert, is likely to face increasing pressure. And in fact, now the foreign minister has called on Prime Minister Olmert to resign. I'm wondering if perhaps you could talk just a little bit about what's likely to happen now within Israeli politics as a result of this the report.
Well, this committee is the Winograd Committee, and it's been investigating what happened last summer for several months now. I think it's inevitable that Olmert will be forced out. I mean, the unusual thing about Ehud Olmert, the prime minister, is that he's one of the few leaders of the country who hasn't had a very strong military background. There was already suspicion about his ability to handle the country's handling of the war. Now, as we saw, Israel performed very weakly, very poorly against Hezbollah. It suffered continual rocket attacks, and this undermined Olmert's credibility. And I don't think he'll survive the next few months. I think when you can see his own foreign minister turning on him like that so quickly after the report comes out, it's not a good sign. He's not a popular prime minister. He has one of the lowest ratings we've seen in Israel's history for a prime minister. And I think his days are numbered. So, he's likely to face the chop, I think.
I think that you know, as much as I have read about this, and certainly not claiming to be an expert on politics of Israel, I've never really quite understood the motivation behind the attack on Hezbollah and this protracted war in Lebanon, and whether this was a case of they thought it was going to be one thing and it turned out to be something else. It was a case where, as you say, Mr. Olmert, perhaps he was interested in proving that he was tough in the military sense and that somehow this got away from him. Certainly, I think you would have to ask the question, ultimately, who was the winner? If you look at their position now in the politics of Lebanon and their standing in the Arab world, I think you probably would have to say that, in fact, Hezbollah came away as the winner of this conflict.
Definitely came away the winner of the conflict. I mean, I think there are two ways of looking at this. One is to say that Olmert pushed the army to do something that they weren't ready to do. And that's the position Olmert has been suggesting. Sorry, he's been saying that you know, he was in charge of the decision to go to war. He formulated the plan. He pushed it. I find that personally very improbable. Israel has had a history of having generals as prime ministers. The army is highly integrated into the government. They're key in making decisions about Israel's defense, its posture towards its Middle Eastern neighbors, and so on. So I think the idea that Olmert, a novice, a military novice, ran this war, I think, is unlikely. He's taken that position, and to a certain extent, the Winograd Committee has backed him on that and suggested that he was at fault, and that therefore the implication is that he should go. But actually, I think it's more likely, and although, of course, these things aren't done in public. I mean, these are very private decisions taken secretively. But my impression, reading between the lines and from the few leaks that have come out, that actually the army was very much preparing for this war, had been preparing for it for some time, and that Olmert was really just the rubber stamp for it. He was presented with a series of proposals about what Israel would do if there was any kind of provocation on its northern border from Lebanon. And when that provocation arrived with the capture of two soldiers, he approved the war, and the army ran it the way they were planning to run it. Now, there are a lot of indications that the army thought it was run for the first time by somebody from the Israeli Air Force rather than from the army, that he could bomb Hezbollah into submission in a few days. I mean, the view seems to have been that within 3 or 4 days, Hezbollah would be destroyed. Obviously, as we saw, that didn't happen, and that the army had no fallback position. There was no second plan if they failed to achieve the victory within a few days. And so really what's happened now is a lot of soul-searching in Israel about why everything went so wrong and why the plan didn't work out, why there were so many misjudgments and miscalculations about what would happen when they went to war. So now we're seeing that being played out.
Well, this, I think, just to underscore what you've said, this was not something that was undertaken impulsively at the spur of the moment, just at when these Israeli soldiers were taken by Hezbollah. As you say, there's good reason to believe that this attack was something that the Israeli military had been thinking about and planning for a long time. It was something that was, in effect, on the shelf and ready to go. All they needed was a reason to do it. Having said all that, one wonders, you know, given the fact that they would have had a lot of time to think about how they were going to do this, why it is that when it was actually put in place, that it went so wrong.
Well, on the first point there, I mean, I think it's important to remember that there were a lot of reports, including in the American media, about how Israeli army officials had come to the U.S. to discuss with the Pentagon plans for attacking Lebanon. There were reports in various American newspapers about this more than a year before the war actually broke out, and that the Israeli general staff were giving PowerPoint presentations about how to attack Lebanon. So this has been something I think, yes, clearly was being formulated for quite some time and had American approval. I think it's important to point out as well. But as you say, things didn't turn out the way they expected. Why did they make such a miscalculation? I think, to be honest, for rather ignoble reasons, which were that they just assumed that as Israel had always defeated its Arab enemies so quickly, it would do so again. I think there was a mentality there that dates back to the Six-Day War in 1967, you know, where they defeated the several Arab armies in a few days, they thought they could take on a militia of a few thousand fighters in even less time, that it would just be a cakewalk for them. And they were sadly misinformed about that. And I think what they've learned and what the Arab world has learned is that actually this kind of guerrilla warfare done by very tight, closed militia groups, which have their own intelligence abilities and that don't share their information with a wider society, can actually resist big armies, including the Israeli army. And I think that message is being learned right across the Middle East right now by Arab insurgents, the resistance, terrorists, whatever you want to call them. But we're seeing it in Iraq, and of course we've seen it in Lebanon. So lessons are being learned here, definitely.
One other dimension, and I know this is something that you have written about, and I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about, is you've argued in a piece that you've written on this that one of the things that the United States was hoping would happen is that Israel would carry this attack not just into Lebanon but also into Syria, which would help to put pressure on, at the very least, to put pressure on the Syrians, and also would serve as a kind of case study of possible attacks against Iran. Is there good reason to believe that that is in fact something the United States was thinking about?
Well, I think there are. I mean, we've got that information from a very impeccable source, a woman called Merav Wurmser, who is the Israeli wife of David Wurmser, who's the advisor to Dick Cheney, the vice president. He's his advisor on Middle East affairs. So she was telling the Israeli media that the reason that the Americans dragged their feet for so long in imposing a ceasefire, why the war just dragged on. We were all looking on saying, why don't they stop this? I mean, it could so clearly and so easily have been stopped. Why did it drag on for so long? Well, the reason is, according to Merav Wurmser, that the White House had decided that Israel should be given a lot of time to destroy Hezbollah. And that this was the plan, that they wanted this to happen, and that then they were going to expand the war to Syria. Now, it didn't happen because Hezbollah resisted and stood up to Israel and couldn't be defeated. The war went on for more than a month. It was clear that they weren't going to be defeated. And at some point, the plug was pulled on the whole adventure. So that's an impeccable source, really. You don't get much better source than that for that information. So I think there are very clear indications that this was an American-backed war by Israel. Israel had full authorization to go ahead, and that it was coordinated very carefully with the Pentagon. And that's not so surprising, because Israel is a key ally of America in the Middle East. America is now deeply mired in the Middle East in its war in Iraq, and it's posturing very strongly for another war with Iran. It's unclear whether that's going to happen or not. But it would be very surprising if Israel was getting involved in regional wars without coordinating that with the Americans. So I think we can just assume that that did happen. And the evidence we're getting from very high-level sources is that it was coordinated.
Let me just introduce again our guest very quickly. Then we have a caller here that we'll get to. We are talking this morning with Jonathan Cook. He's a British journalist. He has been a staff member of the Guardian and Observer papers since 2001. He has been a freelance writer based in Nazareth in Israel, covering the Middle East, writing about Israeli politics and about the Israel-Palestinian conflict. He says he believes he's the first foreign correspondent to be based there in Nazareth. Most of the reporters who write about the region either live in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv or in Ramallah in the West Bank, and he believes that being placed there and also the fact that he's an independent makes it possible for him to pursue stories that otherwise he wouldn't be able to do. His work has appeared in a number of places: The Guardian, The Observer, the Weekly Al-Ahram, The Daily Star of Beirut, The Middle East Report, Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, The Irish Times, Counterpunch, just to name a few. He's spending some time in the United States. He's in Chicago today. Also, by the way, is the author of the book Blood and Religion, The Unmasking of the Jewish and Democratic State, published by the Pluto Press, and came out here in the United States last summer. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have someone in the community of Belgium, not all that far away, on our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sirs. The question I have for you is based on an observation that I've No, I'm sure more than I've noticed it. In the last 50-some years, we've had a view of how Israel is going to attack the situation of their existence in the Middle East, and the fact that they expect to be accepted as a nation, okay? And they use this as a very strong argument as to why the war has to continue on, never trying to move away from that particular thing. Now, I understand that you would expect to be accepted as a nation, but at the same time, this position they've taken isn't working, and it hasn't worked for 50 years because the other people don't want to recognize them, and they don't really recognize Palestine and some of these other countries as legitimate. So they just pursue this war on and on and on and on. And I'm wondering, is this more for the existence of Israel, or is it more for the economy? Because a war economy does generate a lot of money, and it brings in a lot of aid from our country to pursue this war. Now, isn't the paradigm really wrong at this point?
That's a very interesting question. It's a very sophisticated question and understanding of what's going on, I think, yes. I mean, I think that there is a war economy. Israel is a country that I noticed Dick Cheney spoke during the Iraq war. He was talking about war without end. And it strikes me that that model already exists in the case of Israel. Israel is a state that's continually at war with its neighbors. Even when it's at peace with them, it's at war. You know, it's constantly on a war footing. And you're right, that's very good for the economy of Israel. It gets a lot of aid because of that. And it destabilizes the Middle East in a way which I think is deeply damaging to our relations with Middle Eastern states. But it is quite useful in other ways in terms of controlling resources, particularly oil and so on. So I think that there are good reasons why Israel and America have an interest in destabilizing the Middle East and keeping this constant war footing going. But in the long term, is it a good idea? No, of course it isn't. And I think part of the problem for Israel is that it will always have this problem of recognition in the region because it's asking for a very strange kind of recognition. You know, most states are asking for recognition as a state, where as a state of a group of citizens of that state. Israel isn't asking for that. It's asking for recognition of its right to exist as an ethnic state, which is a rather different proposition. It's asking for recognition to be a Jewish state, a state of the Jewish people. And that's a big problem anyway. Anywhere in the world, that would be a big problem. But it's a particular problem in the Middle East because it's sitting in an area of land which is also inhabited by another people, the Palestinians, both in terms of the occupied people of Palestine, the bits of Palestine that are left, the West Bank and Gaza, but also people who are living in what is now called Israel, but who are Palestinians as well. Now, they live inside, there are more than a million of them, they're a fifth of the population. I live in one of their communities, Nazareth. They live as nominal citizens of this state, but they don't really exist as proper citizens because Israel doesn't, they're not Jewish, and therefore it doesn't see them as part of its future. They're not Jewish. They want to be a Jewish state. They want to be recognized as a Jewish state. So what are they going to do about this fifth of the population, which is growing all the time, who are not Jews, who are not Jewish? And this is a big issue inside Israel. It's not an issue that I think people outside Israel have much understanding of. There's not much debate or discussion in the media about it. But it's a huge question inside Israel. And I think this is a major part of the problem. The fact that we don't focus on it, we don't look at it, we don't think about it, means we don't really have an understanding about what is the problem of when Israel talks about its right to exist. What does that mean? What does it entail? And what does it entail for Palestinians who live there? So I think that really we need to get a much more sophisticated understanding of what's happening.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks. Well, I'll ask you to expand on that because, as we have said, you live in Nazareth, which is the largest Arab city in Israel. So it's inside Israel, but it's in an Arab city. And I wonder how it is, you know, what sort of understanding you gain, what sort of perspective, why is it different living as you do and trying to report on this conflict from the kind of perspective you get in Nazareth, how is that, for example, different from how maybe you would tell the story or the kind of stories that you would tell if you were in Ramallah in the West Bank?
Well, one of the biggest differences, you know, what happens is if you're living in occupied territories, like a city like Nablus or Ramallah, or you're living in Gaza, is that you're living in a space in which Israel is at war with the occupied territories almost continuously. You know, there's an occupation going on. It's invading. Its soldiers are attacking Palestinians, and so on. So you're living in a zone which looks like a war zone, and it becomes very easy to believe that it is a war zone, and that's the reason why Israel is attacking. It needs to attack these areas because it's facing an enemy, and it's in a hostile environment, and it needs to fight. The difference is when you're living among Palestinians inside Israel, there's no war going on. Nobody's fighting anybody. The Palestinians have been Israeli citizens or nominal citizens. Some people call them second-class citizens. I don't even think that they have a second-class citizenship. We could talk about that maybe in a minute. But you're not living in a hostile zone. You're living inside Israel. Now, you're under Israeli laws. But the interesting thing is, therefore, you would think that what you would have is a space where people could live as Israeli citizens, as normal Israeli citizens, as if they were Jews. But, of course, that's not the kind of situation you find yourself in. When you're living in a Palestinian community inside Israel, and as I said, they're a fifth of the population, what you find isn't just even discrimination. What you find is an entire system of government and administration which is designed to exclude these people from existence within the state, to de-recognize them as citizens. And that exists in all spheres of life, from land ownership, political representation, their very status as citizens, their employment, possibilities for employment, their education. Everything is compromised by the fact that they are Arabs or Palestinians living inside a state that calls itself a Jewish state. So it touches their life in every possible way. And that really puts a different perspective on what's going on for me, because there's no excuse for this. You can't look at it and say, well, there's a war going on. We have to behave this way. We have to occupy these areas with soldiers. We have to use tanks and guns and fighter jets. None of that is happening inside Israel. These Palestinian citizens have been quiescent. They've been willing citizens for 50, 60 years. They've been trying to become real citizens of Israel, and they've been treated appallingly, to be honest with you, for those decades. So this says something about Israel's attitude towards the Palestinians, which has nothing to do with the occupation. It has nothing to do with hostility or war. And that's what I think is important about living in a place like Nazareth.
Do they feel, that is, the Palestinian people living in Nazareth, do they feel connected to, they certainly must feel connected to, but maybe the question is, in what way do they feel connected to Palestinians living in the territories, and do they somehow feel connected to Palestinian politics?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a tricky question. I mean, I don't think that there's a single answer to that question. What happened for the first 20 years that Palestinians were living as citizens inside Israel is that they lived under military dictatorship. This, is again, is a period of history, Israeli history, that isn't much discussed. But for the first 20 years, if you're a Palestinian citizen living inside Israel, the only democratic right you had was the right to vote in the Knesset. Every other right you had, well, the rest of your citizenship was compromised by living under a military dictatorship. You had to get a permit to go and visit relatives, to step outside of your community, your village, or your town. It was a very strict form of military occupation, really, in those days, of Palestinian areas inside Israel. Now, that's ceased, but in that 20 years, the identity that Palestinians had was really broken down. They were really stripped of any understanding of themselves as Palestinians. There's a generation of Palestinian citizens who don't really see themselves almost as Palestinians. That whole identity of being a Palestinian and being connected to other Palestinian communities was removed. That's finished, that period. Now Palestinian citizens inside Israel are able to watch television like Al Jazeera. They have much more. They're no longer restricted to being educated in an Israeli school system, separate school system designed to make them unaware of their Palestinian identity. So the younger generation are much more aware of the fact that they're Palestinians. And this is causing a lot of concern to Israel. Israel doesn't want them to know that they're Palestinians, doesn't want them to know that they're a national minority inside Israel and that they have rights and that they have an identity and a culture. It's trying to strip all that away from them. Now they're trying to reassert those rights. Israel is seeing that as a big problem. But, I mean, it exists even in a more complex fashion than that. And the Palestinian leadership inside Israel has been at the forefront of trying to develop links with the Palestinians in the occupied territories. It's faced a lot of problems because it's been trying to do that kind of work. Israel rejects any attempts at making these kind of links, and is delegitimizing the leadership of the Palestinians inside Israel. So they are suffering. I mean, there's a leading member of the Knesset right now, Dr. Hazmi Bashara, who's being accused of treason. He's now in exile, effectively, because Israel says that he'll be arrested. He may be executed if he returns. So they're facing threats in many different ways. It's very difficult for them to form alliances with the Palestinians in the occupied territories. If they do, they're usually accused of treason for doing so. So this is a big problem. But I think, as I said, I think it goes even wider than this, because one of the main political platforms for the Palestinians inside Israel, and it's a recent thing, it's only last 10 years since the Oslo peace process started, they started arguing for something called a state of all its citizens. They say Israel should be reformed from a Jewish state into a state of all its citizens. Now, by that, they mean Israel should become a liberal democracy. Everybody should be treated equally. Everybody should have equal rights. Israel is very upset about that. It doesn't like this campaign. One of the leaders of this campaign is Hazmi Bashara, this politician who's now living in exile. And I think one of the reasons he's facing these charges of treason is because he's been promoting an agenda of democratization inside Israel, and Israel can't handle that and refuses to accept it.
Well, just I have a couple of callers here we'll get to in just a moment. But is from your perspective, would you say that here the bottom line for a lot of Israelis, non-Arab Israelis, is that they're worried about becoming a minority in their own country?
Sure. I mean, they have their own concerns. But, I mean, you don't do that. You don't make your position safer. You don't secure your future by treating other people the way you fear you might be treated yourself one day. I mean, that's not a recipe for a solution to the conflict. There are many possible solutions to the conflict, and the people who live there must be the ones to make those kind of decisions. But they must do it in good faith and in a spirit of peacemaking, not in a spirit of war-making.
Well, we have callers. Let's talk with some. Next is someone in Champaign County, here where we are. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to return to the war in Lebanon, and it seems to me that this documentation you're talking about from the Cheney's office could easily be a cover for what might actually have been the case, which is that the U.S., far from acquiescing, and was actually a major actor and planner and initiator of the war. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's quite possible. I mean, I think, but I think that to say whether America was in charge of this war or Israel, in a way, kind of misses the point a little bit, because I think what was happening was that this was highly coordinated, and it was in both countries' interest to pursue this war. Who started it? Who came up with the ideas? Who drafted the plans? I think is less interesting than the fact that Israel and America saw with one vision a future for the Middle East, which involved America becoming more deeply mired in Iraq and possibly in Iran. And I mean, I think what we're seeing, and I think we may still see it emerge, is a vision of the Middle East which is entirely destabilized, with America and Israel trying to encourage factionalism, civil wars within countries, and eventually the partition of states that are seen as a threat to American and Israeli dominance of the region, to weaken countries like Iran. I mean, it's not a surprise Iraq and Iran are the particular focus of this, because they're both very large states. In the past, they've both been militarily very strong, and they've been seen as regional challenges to Israel's dominance of the region. So it's not surprising that both Israel and America would want to see them weakened. And what's going on right now is weakening them, of course, in a very dangerous fashion, in a way that's costing a lot of lives, both a huge number of lives in Iraq, but also a large number of lives among American servicemen. So it's not surprising that we're seeing things going the way they're going, I think, because of this neoconservative vision of the Middle East, which is very similar to the Israeli vision of it. But as I say, I'm not sure it's so important who decided this, who originated the plans. I think the point is that both America and Israel have the same vision of the Middle East, and it's a very dangerous one. It's a one that, we've seen the language of the war on terror, the clash of civilizations. All of this is kind of idea of global chaos and disaster and confrontation and hostility and war without end. And I think these ideas are widely accepted in Israel, And I think there's a strong constituency still for them in the U.S., and that's the worry, and I think it's something that needs to be challenged.
I agree, and I think that's an important point you're stressing, is that instability is actually the goal as opposed to this pretense of intervening for democracy, et cetera, et cetera. I had another more specific question, which is we always hear about, well, on this show particularly, we hear, why don't the Palestinians do nonviolent resistance? Why do they default to violence? And what my premise is that there is a lot of that going on. You've seen a lot of it in and out of the West Bank, and that just isn't reported. To the extent that a Nobel laureate from Ireland can be shot at a peaceful demonstration, and very little impact here. I mean, Rachel Corrie was run over by a bulldozer, and it's still not a terribly celebrated and known story in the regular press. So I thank you for your work and courage, Mike.
Thank you. But I mean, I think that's a very good point you're making. What we see is we hear little bits, news briefs, when an international is killed or injured at these kind of nonviolent demonstrations. But, of course, there are Palestinians dying at these demonstrations all the time, and we don't hear about it. Nonviolence is a routine of life for the Palestinians and has been for years. That demonstration the Belin demonstration where the woman was shot, that's been going on for more than 2 years now. I mean, every Friday there's a nonviolent demonstration there. And every Friday the army comes and they fire rubber bullets and live ammunition at the demonstrators, and regularly people are injured and sometimes people are killed, and there's just very, very rarely coverage of that. I think it's also worth pointing out that every time a child goes to school, that's an act of nonviolent resistance to the occupation, because you can't go to school if you're a Palestinian without passing through military checkpoints. Whether you go to school or not is determined by whether the soldiers will let you go. So nonviolent resistance happens all the time. We just don't cover it. And I think there's a real double standard there when people start criticizing the Palestinians when they use violence, when we don't cheer them when they use nonviolence, when we ignore them when they use nonviolence. What can we expect? If they get no coverage, they get no interest, no concern, no compassion from us when they use nonviolence, and they get criticism for us when they do use violence, well, that's a terrible double standard.
We're a bit past the midpoint here, and I have another caller I will get right to, but I do want to introduce again our guest for anyone who might have just tuned in. We're talking with Jonathan Cook. He is a British journalist. He is based in Israel in the city of Nazareth. It's in the north. It is the largest Arab-Israeli city in Israel. He has been a staff member of the Guardian and Observer papers between 1996 and 2001. Since 2001, he's been working as a freelancer based in Nazareth, covering the Middle East. And he says that he feels that gives him much greater freedom to write the stories that he wants to write. And being there in Nazareth also gives him a perspective that's different from that of reporters that would be living in other places like Jerusalem or Tel Aviv or in the West Bank. He is the author of the book Blood and Religion, The Unmasking of the Jewish and Democratic State, published by the Pluto Press, available here in this country starting last summer. His work has appeared in a number of places, The Guardian, The Observer, The Times, all British papers, The International Herald Tribune, Al Ahram Weekly out of Cairo, The Daily Star from Beirut, The Irish Times of Dublin, The Middle East Report and Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, both Washington-based publications. He's spending some time here in the United States, traveling around and talking, and in fact, today he is in Chicago. He is here on this program as a result of a number of requests from listeners, and we can't always, but we do try to follow up on requests from people who listen to the station for topics that we should cover and guests that we should have. So questions here are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Next is someone in Urbana, here where we are. This is line two. Hello.
Hello. You've examined the advantages to Israel of a state of war. I wonder if you can carry it a step farther. Would peace actually threaten the existence to Israel? Would the internal fissures tear Israel apart?
I think that's, I mean, again, that's a very interesting question. These are interesting questions. There's actually a lot of debate inside Israel about this, surprisingly, but Israelis are very aware of the divisions People often think of Israel and the Jewish state as though it's some kind of very homogenous society, a lot of consensus, but of course there are huge divisions. People come from all sorts of different backgrounds. It's an immigrant state, and a very recent one at that. And so there are a lot of tensions, religiously, ethnically, socially, and ideologically, of course. So there are a lot of pressures inside Israel, and about the only thing that keeps Israelis together, and even Israelis will often say this, is that their hatred of the Arabs, as they say, and their sense that they're surrounded on all sides by enemies. And so there is a question about what would happen if peace broke out in the Middle East and Israel made peace with its neighbors. Where would that lead? I think, inevitably lead to a lot of the questions about what kind of society Israel wanted to be coming to the fore, and it would lead to a lot of division and a lot of tension. For instance, there's a very large and growing population of ultra-Orthodox there, known as the Haredim, and they're not really Zionists. They want a state, a God-fearing state. They want a state where the Torah, religious law, it dominates the legal system and so on, which, of course, most secular Israeli Jews would not stand for. So there are a lot of tensions, it's true. But I don't think it's just that reason for why Israel promotes, if you like, war without end in the Middle East. I mean, I think that there are also issues which are much larger global issues. Its significance to the U.S. is very important. I mean, it gets funded to the tune of billions of dollars every year, and I think there would be a question mark over that kind of financing of Israel if it was just at peace with its neighbors, if it wasn't serving some kind of useful role in the Middle East, regional role. So I think that's very important, and I think that the military industry in Israel is very important. There's a lot of coordination between Israel and America in terms of development of technology and testing of military hardware. Some people have referred, I mean, Israelis I'm talking to here, have referred to the occupied territories, the West Bank and Gaza, as testing grounds, laboratories for American and Israeli military hardware, how to test it, and how to use urban warfare, how to use techniques, for instance, that have been used by American soldiers in Iraq. They're tested first in the occupied territories. So there are a lot of interests, economic ones, in perpetuating this kind of war, this regional war in the Middle East.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. How would you respond to those people who would say, those people who would clearly be supporters of Israel, concerned about Israeli security, who would say that the big problem is here, it does come from the side of the Palestinians, and particularly those who are militant, and that the big issue here is the continuing refusal of people on the side of the Palestinians, now particularly Hamas, to refuse to accept the existence of Israel and continue to act as if they believe that it is possible by using violence to get what they want, either the destruction of the State of Israel, or if not the destruction of the State of Israel, then whatever their political agenda is.
Well, I mean, I think there's a problem with that kind of position, because for a start, it ignores the fact that Hamas is not some kind of monolithic organization. It's not just a militia. It's also a political organization. It's also a welfare organization. I mean, it runs hospitals and orphanages and so on. But it also has a very strong political leadership who are fairly pragmatic and have shown that pragmatism time and again. Now, one of the interesting things, features of Israel's treatment of Hamas has been, I mean, one of the things we should also remember is that Israel was key in legalizing and allowing the Muslim Brotherhood, which was, if you like, the forerunner of Hamas, to set itself up in Gaza and West Bank. Israel actually was quite keen for Hamas to be successful in the occupied territories, and there was a good reason for that, because at that time, Fatah, the Palestinian, and the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, were dominant in the occupied territories, and they were national liberation movement, secular, and Israel was worried about that and wanted to weaken them by encouraging Islamic fundamentalism, what it thought would be a very conservative Islamic fundamentalism, and thought that these Islamic fundamentalists wouldn't organize resistance to Israeli occupation, and they were obviously proved wrong in that. So Israel has actually been formative in creating Hamas. But the important thing to remember is that Hamas has very strong political leadership, pragmatic leadership. It's assassinated most of those pragmatic leaders, some of whom have said they were quite prepared to come to some kind of accommodation with Israel. Maybe they didn't come straight out and say, we'll recognize you, but that's part of the negotiating process. But they said, we're prepared to accommodate some kind of recognition of Israel. Those people who have been killed, they were assassinated several years ago, most of them. And now we have a younger leadership. Some of them are more radical, some of them are more militant, but there are still a lot of pragmatists there. The problem is that it depends how you treat them. If you treat Hamas as just militiamen who want to destroy you and you use violence against them, and that's the only tool you use against them, then, of course, you encourage more militarism from them. Now, if you try and encourage the political leadership, the people who are more pragmatic, who want to negotiate, who already talking about long-term truce with Israel, which is a kind of first stage of recognition, if you encourage these people, then it may be that you can move Hamas in a different kind of direction. We've seen that in other places in the world. We saw it with the treatment by Britain of Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA. There's no reason why this wouldn't also apply to Hamas. But Israel's not interested in trying that approach at all. What it does is it kills the political leaders and it leaves the military guys who are underground and much harder to find. In the main, these guys are untouched. So it's strengthening them all the time and weakening the political leaders. And that's a foolhardy policy, I think.
And you believe that is an intentional policy?
Well, I think it might be, yes. I mean, I think it fits into a picture of Israel needing to be at war, as we've discussed already. Mm-hmm. If Israel needs to be at war, for various reasons, to be useful to Israel, to stop these internal fractures within its own society, to get its huge subsidies from America, then yes, it does need to be at war. And then we really ought to look at what kind of state Israel is and start to think in the West whether we want to be subsidizing a state like that.
Let's talk again with someone else. This is Champagne in line one. Hello.
Yes, I'm calling. I just want to be as objective about this as I can. I just want justice to prevail in the Middle East, whatever justice is. But two questions that come to mind are basically what I hear supporters of Israel and its policies say. One, politically, Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and for that reason, if no other reason at all, the United States is justified in the tremendous amount of subsidies that it provides, much in the way of armaments per year, every year. And secondly, and I hope I'm not out on a limb on this, in terms of a religion and the evangelical right, that Israel in some way is a fulfillment of a biblical prophecy, and for that reason, and of course I guess as the president is maybe a little bit evangelical, he could buy into this, that Americans should support Israel in that regard. Will you comment on both of those justifications?
Well, yeah, let's deal with the second one, the evangelicals. I mean, I think that the Christian Zionists, as they're often referred to, are important in terms of the level of support that Israel has in America and in terms of fundraising and its political kind of leverage. There's no doubt that they're an important factor in that. I'm not sure that some people argue they're the decisive factor. I don't think that's probably true. I think if America wanted to change its policy towards Israel, it could do it quite easily, even given the very sympathetic coverage that Israel receives, the fact that most Americans don't have much idea of what's going on in the Middle East. I think still policy could be changed. Israeli aggression in the Middle East could be reined in. Different kinds of leaders could be encouraged. Different kind of policies could be pursued. I think that's quite possible, even with the Christian Zionists having the kind of power that they have. The problem is I don't think there's any interest in among the American leadership at the moment in doing that. Certainly this administration, Israel is getting a free hand to do what it wants, and we're seeing where that might lead. Because it ties in again with American policy, as we're seeing unfolding in Iraq, there's a very clear kind of parallels between what's going on in Iraq and what's been going on in the occupied territories. You know, we're now seeing walls being built in Baghdad, just like the walls that have been built throughout the West Bank. I was reading in today's Chicago Tribune that yesterday there were mortar rounds being fired into the Green Zone. I mean, this has strong echoes of the mortars that are fired by Palestinians into Israel. That's what happens when you wall people off, if you seal them into prisons, and they can't protest, they can't fight, they can't do anything. All they can do is fire mortars. So it's not surprising we're seeing similar kinds of things happening in both places. And the longer that goes on, the danger is that America starts, and Americans, the American public, start to feel the same kind of sense of besiegement, of facing a global enemy, and so on. This just becomes stronger and stronger. And that's very useful for Israel, because Israel believes that's its role in the world. If it can encourage Americans to see the world in the same with through the same kind of lenses, then it's got a very, very powerful ally pursuing exactly the same kind of path. That's the real danger here, I think, that the mindset becomes so, they become so closely allied that it just becomes impossible for Americans to start seeing any other kind of future. That was the answer maybe to the second question. Could you remind me quickly what the first...
Yeah, the fact that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and of course America is a democracy, and for that reason we should be in the business of supporting the only democracy in the Middle East.
The problem with the idea of democracy is actually it's a kind of nebulous term. What does democracy mean? There are different kinds of democracy. You know, and historically, I mean, if you go and talk to a political science professor, he'll explain there are different kinds of varieties of democracy, just like there are different varieties of baked beans. You know, and the one that most of us support is liberal democracy. It's the idea that people's rights are protected, that it's not just majority rule, that whatever the majority says goes, and everybody else's rights are trampled on. Now, one of the important things to remember about Israel is it's not a liberal democracy under any definition. It's not the kind of democracy we mean when we talk about democracy. It's ruled by the majority. It's tyranny, actually, by the majority. And the majority is Jewish. And it does, and the Jewish majority can do what it likes to the non-Jewish minority. So I'm not sure that's quite the idea of democracy that we have anyway. But I also think that Israel has other aspects to its kind of rule. Its system of government that we're not too aware of either. One of the important ones is that it has very strong theocratic elements to the government, the administration there. The rabbis are in charge of very major aspects of people's lives. And I think one of the states that Israel is often compared to by experts on these kinds of things is Iran, ironically enough, where people have the vote, but the religious authorities actually have a fairly strong say in things. The other aspect of it, of course, is it's very strongly ruled by the generals, if you like. I mean, usually they have their representative in the government. He's usually the prime minister, actually. But even when he's not, as in the case of Ehud Olmert, the army is always there as not only just an advisor, but also as a key policymaker. And that's very different from most countries as well, where the army actually makes the decisions about how things shall be run, what must be done. And that goes back to the original point I was making at the start, which is I think that the war was waged in Lebanon, for instance, last summer by the army, not by the government. The government went along with what policy that had already been decided by the army.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. As a way of finishing up here, we just have a couple of minutes left. Here in the United States, I think people look at the coverage that large news organizations, the quote-unquote mainstream media, give to the Middle East. And it seems that both people who are strongly sympathetic to the perspective of Israel and who are concerned about its existence, and people who are strongly sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinians and what daily life is like, particularly under Israeli occupation, both of those people are critical of what's written, who say essentially either the people who are pro-Israeli says, the press, they're pro-Palestinian. The people that are very concerned about the Palestinians says, no, that what happens is that it's really not covering what's really going on. Can you say something about the way that this story is covered, and particularly if you think that somehow big news organizations who devote space to this story somehow are missing something?
Yeah, I mean, I think that unfortunately the media are failing heavily in terms of, I think the most dramatic failure in terms of the coverage by the media, particularly the American media, I think is particularly poor in this regard, is they don't really give you any historical context for what's going on. It's like you suddenly land in the Middle East, in Israel, Palestine, that day, and you're explaining what's going on in a conflict that dates back at least 60 years, and some people would argue a lot longer than that, more than a century. There are a lot of historic grievances. There's been a lot of mistreatment of the Palestinians, erosion of their rights, trampling of their rights, their loss of their homeland. these things just really aren't discussed in the American media. What it all starts from today, and therefore it's very easy to kind of sell this as all about terrorism and attacks on Israelis and so on, without looking at why these attacks are happening, what led up to them. You know, during the Oslo process, everybody spoke as though peace was just around the corner, Palestinians and Israelis were going to live next door to each other. What they didn't cover was the fact that Israel was expanding its settlements across the occupied territories, that it was stealing more and more land from Palestinians, and it was eroding more and more of their rights. And so it wasn't when suddenly the Intifada erupted in 2000, for Americans, I think it was like, well, where did this come from? We thought peace was just about to arrive. Well, that was all building up. The pressure was building up. And Americans, I don't think, were too aware of that pressure building up because they weren't getting that coverage in their media. And that's been the big failure. There's been very little context for this, very little historical background for the average reader. And if you don't have that, it's very difficult to understand what's going on.
Well, we are going to have to stop because we've here come to the end of the time. I want to say again thanks to our guest, Jonathan Cook. He is a freelance writer based now in Nazareth in Israel, covering the Middle East there since September 2001. Before that, he also was a staff member of the Guardian and Observer newspapers. His work has appeared in a number of places, those papers, as well as the International Herald Tribune, Al Aram Weekly, the Daily Star of Beirut, the Middle East Report out of Washington and other places. If you're interested in reading some of his reporting, probably the easiest thing to do would be to go to his website, which is www.jkcook.net. You can also look for his book, his first, Blood and Religion, The Unmasking of the Jewish and Democratic State, published by the Pluto Press, came out in the United States last July. Right now, at the moment, he's spending some time in the United States. He's in Chicago. Mr. Cook, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.